I'm Michelle McMurray, and I direct the health program at the Aspen Institute, and I just wanted to greet you in coming into the second session of this very provocative panel on social entrepreneurship and health. And your two hosts for this session are Bill Hazeltine, who's over to my right, who's probably most well-known for being one of the co-founders of Human Genome Sciences and chairman and Harvard professor, and has done amazing work in HIV, and is now turning his attention to the issue of more efficiency in healthcare, and using India as an example. And John Michael Lin, who is the co-founder of a foundation with Hazeltine to look at some of these issues. So let the panel begin.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. The title is Can Social Healthcare Be Sustainable? And we just completed an interesting hour led by Bill and some of our panelists, which focused on what we have learned in India from some rather interesting models. Before I introduce the panel, let me just give you a little bit of a background here of what our purpose is here. I have spent the last 12 years or so in India and have been fortunate to see India's growth as an economic and political power in the world. However, on the healthcare side, India remains one of the poorest countries in the world. It accounts for one-third of the poor in the world. And the massive healthcare system in India is brutally inefficient. Thanks to Bill Hazeltine, he has a keen interest in all things that are global, and I found that he knows more about India than I do. And in fact, he exposed me and introduced me to some very interesting and very unexpected examples that we are calling centers of excellence, really, that we found in India. And I think that, to put everything into perspective, I think people tend to be very skeptical when you tell them that you have found a really efficient, world-class health center in India. Our statement is really that these centers of excellence deliver a couple of things. They deliver world-class medicine, as we have heard in the previous hour. And to illustrate that in its simplest form, because there's a great deal of skepticism when we say that a lot of efficiency and cost can be achieved in India through these unique centers, people think immediately that the compromise is quality. But they must have more infections than we do here on their eye procedures. They must have a higher mortality rate. And the number one qualification we have for identifying these systems is that they are world class. And the only way I can illustrate it to you is that I would subject my two dearest or three dearest people in the world to healthcare in India, my two sons and my wife. At any of these facilities that we talk about, which I think should illustrate it if you put yourself in that position. The second thing we're looking for is social impact. We're looking not just for private hospitals that are providing good healthcare. We're actually looking for systems that in an area of need like India are having a true social impact. Therefore, we're not talking about a private practice that has 50 patients. We're talking about practices that have an effect on millions and millions of lives and hundreds of thousands of procedures, and they do so efficiently. And then the last element that we're looking for is sustainability, which is the topic here. Globally, we all struggle with healthcare systems that are economically challenging, especially if they involve some government support or if they have social goals, then sustainability and economic viability as well as quality compromise immediately come into mind. So our three pillars that we're looking for are world-class healthcare, social impact, and sustainability. And that's really what we are here for. And the last introductory point I'll simply make, which is this is very self-serving, and I want to point that out. Bill and I, after we discovered these great systems, wanted to find a way of promoting, supporting, and sharing. these systems. And so we set out to first of all learn about them. What are these systems about? So we have actually been studying them in detail, in person. We have also brought together people to share what their systems are about. This track today is really the second conference, really. The first conference we hosted in December of last year in Delhi. We brought together about 35 social entrepreneurs in India. And it was done together with the Aspen Institute of India and the Aspen Institute and the Global Business Coalition for HIV/AIDS. And that was really built to learn and to start defining some best practices. We today are hopefully again in a forum where we're actually still learning, and our next goal is to have another conference at the Aspen Institute's healthcare conference in April here, and Bill and I are in the process of developing a foundation, and that foundation will take these best practices and start implementing them, start supporting them. We will literally help build some of these systems in India, and then we hope to learn more and start promoting these outside of India and seeing where else can they apply. And of course the ultimate interesting aspect would be, can some of these principles even apply here? I mean, why not? We have tremendous healthcare issues here. Why not some of these cost efficiencies that we see in other areas? And why not some of the processes that we see in these other areas? So that's why we are here, and why today, for the next hour and a half, or whatever's remaining after my lengthy intro, we will hopefully delve more into the real practical issues of sustainability. And we're sitting around a round table, we're all together, and I really invite you to interrupt, to participate, and to ask, and to challenge, and to contribute, because that's really what this session is far more about. So perhaps I could ask just the panelists to introduce themselves for 2 minutes and to say what they're doing and perhaps their perspective on this notion of healthcare, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. Bill, I still think you don't need introduction, but I think it's probably worthwhile.
Bill Hasseltine, I'm the chairman of a new company called Hasseltine Global Health and the president of the Hasseltine Foundation, which is involved with John Michael in sponsoring this and other what we call Access Health. And we are very serious about working on problems of providing high-quality, low-cost health to the poor and middle class everywhere in the world. We think that we found very interesting examples in India. I think the panel that we just got through showed that there's some very interesting working examples. We would like to see this type of health practice become established globally, especially in the United States, because that's what we did. And we think that you can deliver, as was described, high-quality health care at about 1/20th in the U.S. My guess would be 1/20th the current cost. They do it in India at 1/50th the current cost, between 1/30th and 1/50th the current cost for things like heart surgery. And the outcomes, as John Michael mentioned, are as good, in some cases better than our best outcomes. So if they can do it, why can't we learn what they're doing? Because if we don't do that, our future is a degraded healthcare service for ourselves, for our children. And my own agenda here is getting knowledge to patients for patient benefit. All this grand new knowledge that I've been working with all my colleagues on for the last 30 years, genomics, proteomics, all these omics that you've heard about and medical breakthroughs aren't going to help anybody if we can't afford to pay for them. And I'm deeply concerned. I work with Bell, for example. One of the numbers that scared the pants off me is Bell's 20-year projection for the federal budget. If we don't get healthcare costs under control, we won't have good healthcare. And what's going to happen if we stay on our projection, and Bell, you ought to talk about this, because it is a budget breaker beyond budget breakers. And if you can do it at 1/10th, 1/20th the cost, we can afford a lot of things in this country. If we can't, it won't just be health that suffers, it'll be education, welfare, security, and everything else that will suffer. So this is a major issue. It's not just for India. It's not just for China. It is for the whole world. And I think, by hope, Bell, you'll talk a little bit about some of the some of the budget-breaking implications of our current course.
I'm Alvina Dubois-Rouvray. I run an international NGO, which is FXB, and for 17 years I've been implementing in very, very small programs done hand-in-hand with the communities with which I work, in the framework of the link between health and human rights, development community-embedded programs to raise AIDS orphans or to take care of AIDS orphans and extremely impoverished communities. So we do that in Africa and Latin America, and we're starting in India. So that's all I can say.
Starting in India? I thought you had operations in all 50
states.
Well,
yes, I do, but I have small operations, but I'm in all 35 states.
That's pretty impressive for one
territories.
Foundation.
But I mean, for instance, India. In Lakshadweep, with people who know India, which are far away islands, take a long time to get to, I have a tiny little fisherman's AIDS prevention program, because I felt that fishermen and sailors were the truck drivers of the sea, which is around most of India, and things like that, and we deal with AIDS also. We have bigger programs elsewhere. But we're aiming to sort of replicate what we do well in Africa, for instance, adapting it with the Indians completely to the Indian context to help with this problem of AIDS orphans and development at the same time of very poor communities. So we're starting in the Northeast.
I'm Juan Umana. I'm director of cardiac surgery at a foundation in Bogota, Colombia, where we aim to help find a solution to the problem we have with children with congenital heart defects, our incidence being about 10 times that of the United States, which amounts to about 9,000 children a year, most of which have, of course, no health care coverage. We'll go into how we've approached that, but Bill Hazeltine and I met about 2 months ago, and he immediately picked up on the similarities between our program and that right across the world, CARE Hospital and NH Hospital in Aravind in India, and was kind enough to invite me to come and share our experience with you.
My name is Sachin Rao. I'm not a medical practitioner, nor do I work for a medical NGO. I'm a businessman by training and by preoccupation and by interest. And for the last 8 months, I've been in the field in India. And my firm belief is that the markets of the poor, either in India or in the United States or in sub-Saharan Africa or in China, are underserved, not because of the economics of the market. There's plenty of money out there. It's because we do not have the innovations in our product development and delivery models to meet the needs of the poor. So with that fundamental driving belief, I've been in India for the last 8 months researching industries from banking to retailing to agricultural procurement and to healthcare to see what kind of models have emerged to serve the markets of the poor profitably. And as part of this, John and Bill were kind enough to allow me to be part of the last conference, and I had the opportunity of studying models in healthcare, and that's what I'll share with you today.
I'm Dr. Krishna Reddy, a cardiologist and at CARE Hospital, Hyderabad, India. I thank Bill for inviting us here to share the model that what we have been striving to meet the challenge that India poses us in terms of how to provide quality, I mean, what the modern technology can offer at a cost which the Indian people can afford. Not only that, how to make it accessible geographically and social segments. So we only continue to say that it's a kind of a innovation which is an evolution. So there is certain natural tracks of evolution of this model. It has its own pitfalls, and I think by interacting with the group here, we try to take back some of the ideas and we share what we are able to achieve or what we intend to achieve in the future.
Thank you. We wanted to give a little bit of a broad panel perspective, which is why we have clearly an NGO approach and vision. We find immediately similarities with a country that is literally on the opposite side of the world. of India in Bogota, because we didn't want to present a solely an India-centric or India-centric approach here. But let's also identify a little bit what my goal is at the end of this, is hopefully to have identified further not only some of these best practices, but really some of the conditions that we will look for to go out and support. And in other words, what are the models that we will go out and try and support because we think they're efficient? So my first question is, one of the most successful models on paper that you immediately see is the, and you will hear us talk about, is the Aravind Eye Institute. They've been, if you look at our handout and our publication, which was written by Sachin here, there's a case study on the Aravind Eye Institute. Professor C.K. Prahalad also did a detailed study of the Aravind Eye Institute. That is a very specialized process. Even though there's a broadening away from just the cataract surgery, I don't know what the number is, but my guess would be that still 70 or so percent of their practice is cataract surgeries. So it's a deep degree of specialization. My first question to Dr. Reddy is, if we take it outside of that pure specialization, would you advocate a more holistic approach or a more specialized approach in terms of reaching sustainability in our social goals?
In fact, when we started as a specialized model in terms of the cardiac care. Yeah. However, in the last 5 years, we have been migrating towards a holistic approach in terms of ability to give across the specialties, not just one specialty, and also across different segments of care, different levels of care in terms of tertiary level, secondary level, as well as the primary level. So this is how we have been evolving in terms. So we believe that there has to be a holistic model, but within the holistic model, the centers of excellence in each specialty, so that we target the key, like if you're talking about eye-related problems, cataract constitutes 80%. In terms of the cardiac, in Indian setting, current level, again, the coronary artery disease, the bypass surgery maybe, or angioplasty. So each specialty has at least 2-3 elements which need to be targeted. So a holistic model with centers of excellence in certain specialty to drive down the cost, the high cost procedures, like typically what are the challenges in terms of the bypass surgery, which is a high cost procedure, unlike the cataract surgery. So here the challenge is because we need to depend upon the materials which are imported, and the cost is high, and the overall cost of bypass surgery is high, and the number of people dying of heart disease, coronary artery disease, in the productive years of 30s and 40s is already exceeded the U.S. prevalence and incidence in India.
So let me say, the incidence of heart disease in India?
Yes.
Incidence?
Yes.
Incidence numbers per thousand incidence is significantly higher.
Significantly higher than in the U.S. now.
Is that because of diet, or what is that?
Yeah, it's the diet and the lifestyle changes.
They don't exercise, they need a lot of
oil. It's typical of the country, which is in the transition.
What's the difference in the incidence?
The urban India compared to the New York statistics, the incidence was about 15% compared to 12% in the New York state. Of course, the rural India is less, it's about 3%, but again, that is recently published Australian paper of certain villages in AP has targeted almost equivalent to urban India. So I think though the centers of excellence will give us certain process models, but in terms of achieving the holistic, addressing the whole healthcare sector, the health needs, not in isolation of a specialty, but in a whole, some of these best practices in terms of the specialized centers as well as a rural delivery system. So we have at least a good dozen models which need to be integrated to come up with what you have already tried to achieve in the previous forum, to come up with a comprehensive model of healthcare delivery, incorporating some of these best practices.
Juan, maybe you can comment on the same aspect. I mean, you're also a heart specialist. You focus on child care and specifically. Does that help you in terms of looking for the economics of it, looking for the sustainability, or do you also find a need for a more holistic approach?
We started just to give you an idea of how we were in Bill's example of how the previous system or the obsolete system of donations compared to a balloon that you blow into, and when you stop blowing into it, it gradually collapses, is exactly what we found with our initial model. We started 30 years ago taking care of children that had no means or access to health care purely through donations, and came to the realization that it was impossible to sustain that model. It was clearly not sustainable, which made a shift into our current model, which we've gradually shifted into, which is one whereby we take care of patients, cardiac patients, of all ages, insured as well as non-insured, and have a very cost-efficient operation with regards to the insured patients. In Colombia, a law was passed in 1991 that increased healthcare coverage through managed healthcare organizations, HMOs, but privately managed. Now, the resources of those organizations, of course, are very limited. So you have to be very careful how you charge them. I mean, they do not have unlimited resources. And if you're not careful, you will be operating at a loss. So your operation has to be very cost effective in order to be able to come up with an operating margin that's positive, that allows you to sustain the operation of the hospital as a whole, and particularly the social portion of the operation, which is our reason of being. So we really divided and differentiate between our soul, which is taking care of children with no resources and birth defects, and our core business, which is what allows us to run a sustainable operation. What happened during that process is that we went into that holistic approach and started becoming a general hospital. And what we found was that the more general you become, the more inefficient you get. And as a consequence, your sustainability starts fading away. So we had to rein in that growth in order to concentrate on the core business again. And that was cardiac care as a cardiovascular service line, pediatrics and adults. That, of course, in order for it to be viable from a medical point of view, needs to have support services. So you of course need to have general surgery, you have to have neurology, you have to have a certain number of specialties. But where we believe, and we were talking about this before, I guess I believe in that holistic approach. But that part of the word holistic that we believe in the most is outreach and education in the form of prevention. Any of our countries have a major education and nutritional issue, and those the uneducated, malnourished mothers are the ones that have a greater propensity to have children with congenital defects. So what we're growing into now is a hospital that has all the support services with a central cardiac core that is expanding towards a comprehensive care of the mothers and the children in order to ultimately try to lower the incidence of congenital heart defects and as a consequence lower the load of patients that we have to find resources to operate on.
Michael, can I ask a question? A couple of things that you said I want to compare and contrast a little bit. Your costs are about 2 to 3 times more for heart surgery than his costs, as far as I could tell from a very brief discussion. Is that because you have insurance that will pay for that, and you haven't been forced to drive the costs down like they have? That's maybe not a very polite question, but I wonder why the cost structure is higher, and it's something to explore. The second question that I'd like you guys to explore is you've said that you've tried to become General Hospital, and I know, Sachin, you've worked on this issue a lot, right? And very much for specialization. Yet you are trying to expand into many other areas. How do you see your future? Do you see it as a future of specialized hospitals with a core, or do you see it as a general hospital in which you may run into the same problems that you guys? So those are two separate questions, but I think they're important questions for this model, which is delivering really low cost.
If I may answer the non-polite question, I think one of the main advantages that the CARE Hospital, as well as Aaron and NH have, is that India has access to high technology at a much lower cost than we do. Easy access. The education structure in India is to us enviable, despite all the other social problems. So we have to rely on what I mean. That's one of the main differences between the two models, and it is that whereas they will produce their disposables ultimately at a very low cost, I have to look for other strategies. Eventually,
buy them from them.
Exactly, and eventually, you know, put some money into R&D and do the same thing they're doing: research and develop new products, which would be absolutely ideal. In the meantime, we have to, you know, establish strategic partnerships and alliances. Which we've done with industry, biotech industry, and with academia in the States, institutions in the States that lower our costs in terms of training of physicians, continued medical education, and, of course, costs of consumables.
I thought you're for the second part of the question, which is you're moving toward more broader coverage in the medical city, more or less.
Yeah. I think we still believe that because we are trying to address the healthcare needs of the population, in a model that is works for that population, whether it works for other population, that has to be debated. The second point, so in that context, we experimented with one specialty. But at the same time, the lessons learned from that specialty, we are able to duplicate in other specialties. The second issue which I need to panelists to debate is in terms of when we say the cost in terms of the context of the local population, not in terms of the context of the equation with the dollar. So if we talk in terms of that, in terms of the per capita income versus what is their healthcare cost, if the per capita income here is $20,000 and bypass surgery costs about $30,000 versus per capita income of $1,000 in India and bypass surgery costs $1,500. So in terms of the per capita income, it is equivalent, whatever you call purchasing power parity. So ultimately the challenge is in terms of at what per capita income our healthcare cost should be targeted so that it is easily afforded by that population. If you start equating with the dollar terms, it will slightly pose certain inequalities in terms of affordability definition. So we need to discuss, I mean, I think there may be a point of discussion in that sense.
Yeah. Sachin, maybe you can address it in the context. You know, Sachin has done a lot of studying together with Professor Prahalad in
sort of the bottom of the pyramid, as it's referred to, as in the fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, is there economic viability at the bottom of the pyramid? Because the ground realities that we're talking about here are in India are obviously desperate. And so when we look for sustainability in areas where people are earning a dollar a month, you know, that we have to put it into context. And I'm sure, Juan, in Bogota, you're also dealing with certain economics that we have to compare once we translate those numbers to here. But Sachin, is there economic sustainability at the bottom of the pyramid for healthcare?
Yeah. Let me, before I'll address that question, I just wanted to also touch upon the specialization versus general practice. And just for everyone else who may not have been part of the previous discussion, the core of all these models that we talk about is that they focus on one particular specialization, either a procedure or a region of care, and they just drive down the cost mercilessly in what they pick as their sweet spot. That's what makes all of this work in most of the models. And the debate is that the way to go, or should these people really be just, rather than thinking about themselves as cataract providers, should they see themselves as eye care providers? And what's the trade-off? If they start seeing themselves as eye care providers, does that drive down their efficiency? I mean, that's what this debate was about. And the point I'd make is that General Motors has a full suite of vehicles, everything from an SUV to a roadster and everything in between, right? They don't make all the cars in the same production line. Every single production line is different, and which is how I see, even as the care provided by many of these providers expands, they can retain the efficiency of their core, of the processes that they've made efficient. I mean, Arvind's a great example. 20%, cataracts account for 80% of their costs, revenues, and 20% of their costs. So they've not sacrificed the efficiency of the cataracts, and they've cross-subsidized other treatment through the cataracts. And there are some aspects of eye care, like, for example, primary eye care, that will never be profitable. But as long as you run every procedure in its own production line, you're not going to sacrifice efficiency, and you can get a breadth of service. That's the point, first point I'd make. Second point is with respect to, you know, the economic viability. As a business model, can you set up business models that work for this population? The answer is, as so many of these models have demonstrated, absolutely. And the key to that, you know, number one, I mean, there are two sides to a profit equation. There's revenue that you make, and there is the cost that you incur. The first key is to drive down the cost, not linearly, but geometrically. So the innovations that these people have instituted, these models have instituted in terms of the use of manpower, to the indigenous manufacturing of very high cost components, all of this drives down cost. Right? The second thing that, second essential in the economics of BOP markets is that you will never have very high margins on individual procedures. You're probably making wafer thin margins on every one service that you provide or every one good that you provide. You require very high volumes to make this work. So, you know, that's the other driver. So you require high volumes, you're going to get low return, low margins, and you have to drive down costs mercilessly to make those economics work. So just within these business models, they can be profitable. But the other thing to consider with respect to sustainability is that we already spend an enormous amount of money on healthcare in India. I think it was 3-4% of GDP, if I'm not mistaken, which is not trivial. I mean, India's got a GDP of $700 billion last year. And so, you know, that's not a small sum of money, just being spent badly. And we need to figure out a way to divert the money that goes into inefficient
hospitals. Not as badly as we spend it, I think. Yeah. At least we spend a lot more.
But with more tragic consequences.
You know? And it's a bigger GDP.
Yeah. But our consequences are more tragic. You know, probably not as big as yours, but I mean, the consequences of misspending in India are more tragic. It's just a matter of directing this money better, in my view. So the viability is absolutely there.
He needs a microphone. Does he have a, can we get him? Hand him your microphone. Can you hear?
Can we take it that specialized care versus care, focus versus generality? What is the answer now?
So if I were to summarize my answer, see, the economics, the ability to create affordability in many of the, in Arvind and Narayan Hrudayalaya, maybe in some other places, is that they've driven down the cost of individual procedures. and they've used the, you know, the space that that provides them to subsidize other procedures. So I think there is no, eventually the best, I think the it's not fair to say best, but most compelling models are the ones that provide a full range of service. But ones that do so by creating extreme efficiencies in some parts of their service.
Yeah, I think what we were, sorry, go ahead.
I think it's very important to know that medical care of people is neither cataract nor bypass surgery.
Is neither what?
Not bypass surgery.
Medical surgery, not cataract.
Neither cataract nor bypass surgery is not medical care. The body is an indivisible whole. And then when we talk about something like a cataract operation, which is unique in its simplicity, low technology, and low cost, that's not the way the rest of the body can be dealt with. So in other words, we should not try to impose this model and say this is the way the rest of the body should be taken care of, or whole medicine should be taken care of. We find that if you look at bypass surgery, or for that matter any other surgery anywhere else in the body, it's not simple like cataract. As the population ages, a person who goes through bypass surgery has multiple problems all over the body. And each person, how they react, and what preoperative evaluation they need, what other procedures they need, what support systems they need, what to be done for carotid arteries, what to be done for kidney failure, this and that is enormous complexity. That's the reason why specialized hospitals have significant problems and they are not patient safe. Just want us to be aware of it.
So the model that I've heard you discuss for creating a broad, the biggest criticism, I mean, there are two criticisms for this type of social entrepreneur healthcare that I've seen. The first one is it works for profitable specialties. So how can you extend it? That's a serious criticism. And I know that you guys are trying to address it, so it's worth addressing it in some more detail here. I think it's the issue that we're getting to. The second major criticism is it's not scalable, that you can do it as a non-governmental private operation at a certain scale. Now, I know both of you have plans both to be multi-specialty and hugely scaled. Now, you were very modest in your description. You have a small 1,000-bed operation for cardiac surgery and other things. That's big by most standards. You have much bigger plans. How are you planning to do that and keep the model? I mean, you must have thought this through. I know you well enough to know that you don't speak about things you haven't thought through. So how are you thinking about these two issues?
So the scalability, because already the experience with the 1,000 beds that we had, that we could demonstrate that it is viable, and the same cost effectiveness that we could provide in the cardiac also could be provided to other specialties. And the profitability of the model is able to generate the sufficient funding to replicate the model across the country.
So this is actually happening now. You are doing multi. What specialties do you offer now?
We have everything.
Everything. Cancer?
Yeah.
Diabetes?
Yes.
Kidney?
Everything.
AIDS?
HIV AIDS?
We do.
So you provide multi-service.
We do.
And you're still making money, as we established last time.
Yes.
And you're making enough money to expand with that money, or do you need outside capital to expand?
Expand with the money, with infusion of additional capital or debt. But it's sustainable, I mean, in terms of that.
Please.
I may not have heard very well, and I didn't attend the first session on this, but I'm still unclear what the mechanisms are that drive the cost down. I heard story about specialization that enables low cost, presumably, but I'm still missing what are the drivers of reduced cost per procedure here.
Okay, I think that's an excellent focus point, and I'm going to ask a couple of people here to address that. where we are, I think, in this discussion is that in we started talking about specialization because it seemed that there were areas where it was the specialization itself which afforded the opportunity to find a low-cost
mechanism. That's a Satya and C.K. Prahalad hypothesis.
Right.
It seems to be challenged by Dr. Reddy and Dr. Raja.
Well, and I think what I'm also hearing...
But enforced by Dr. Umana.
Right. And what I'm hearing, by the way, is that when we say holistic, we actually mean both interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary ability to specialize and dig down so deep that within each specialty we still adapt the best practice of a specialized practice of being able to go and cut down into each process and look for cost efficiencies, which I'll ask him to clarify in just a second.
But
holistic also means multidisciplinary, but also in time, I think. I think if we're talking about the 9,000 children with heart congenital defects per year in Colombia, we're talking also that prevention can bring that number down, not only kind of a specialized focus on it. So
now, the first thing I do is direct you to this. Okay, there's some numbers in here, real numbers, real case studies that C.K. Prahalad and Sachin have done, where you can look at some comparative statistics for costs of procedures and outcomes.
So what are
by
the
various
things?
Measures? And so, and we talked about some of this, but maybe.
Yeah. So how are we bringing the cost down?
Scale was mentioned first. How do you bring costs down?
Yeah. In the previous session, that discussion was there. How we could do is, one is in terms of the capital cost, that means containing the capital cost per bed. The second is in terms of capacity utilization, that means if you have a capacity. In comparison with what's happening in the U.S. versus what we are able to do in terms of per capacity, say, a cath lab or 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 other things.
The number you gave was a heart surgeon in the U.S. does 100
yes.
surgeries a year. They
so
do
typically a cath lab, I mean, what we experience here when we visited centers here is about the 6 cath procedures per lab per day. But we are driven to do about sometimes 20 or 30 cases per lab per day. So the similarly, Ecolab, like Mayo Clinic, has about 400 eco machines. They do about 3 eco studies per machine per day. We have to do about 60 eco procedures per day per machine. So that is the second element, that is the capacity utilization. The third element that we are working upon is the material component, because the material component to the cost of procedure accounts to about 30%, one-third of the cost, both in the U.S. as well as in our situation. So we are trying to address the material cost by innovation in the technology development that we are adapting to our local situation. So we are able to come up with cost-effective products by technology innovation. Fortunately, we have drugs which cost about 40 times cheaper. So that is another major element that goes into the cost reduction. And the volumes which you already spoken. So ultimately, I mean, these are the 4 elements that which are...
And there's a fifth element that they don't particularly practice, but other people do, which is manpower, which they use a lot of high school graduates, some of the other hospitals. Aravind and the Bangalore Heart Hospital use a lot of high school graduates. The example that we used was the medical corpsman in the Army around the world to do a lot of the primary procedures, and that's a major cost savings. But the numbers are in some of this handout where you can actually take a look at yourself.
I'd venture to say that the cost of the of a health professional, I mean, that is a phenomenal savings right there. If you could train high school graduates to do jobs that otherwise you would need a nurse to do or even a nurse practitioner to do. For us in Colombia, it would be very hard to justify that because people are tremendously underemployed, which means that we can employ them for a fraction of the cost that you can employ them here or find a similarly trained person here.
Is that true for nurses?
That's true for nurses.
So you should export nurses?
We should. We absolutely should. So, sort of like the Philippines. Yeah. But so that's a major way of lowering costs. Now there's another. When I returned to Colombia about 3.5 years ago, and when I got to the Fundación Cardo Infantil, which is where I work, every single consumable used during cardiac surgery was reused. It says on the package, it says use once. If you translate that literally into Spanish, it means use 11, use 11. So we'd apply that, you know? And that certainly drives costs down. But I personally always question that. And that's a very common practice in developing countries. As we increased our volumes and became more efficient, but the problem is that the more science advances, and the money is certainly in the industry. So whereas most of the studies we have and we produce show that re-sterilization is actually efficient. If you look at molecular studies on those reused catheters, you actually have genomic particles of the last patient when you're reusing that catheter on the next patient. So there's no visible infection. But there's some gene therapy going on. But what we managed to do and that's what I'm trying to drive at is that as we increased our volumes and we became visible on the radars of the industry, biotech industry, we're able to negotiate lower prices by creating strategic partnerships with suture companies, with catheter companies, with biotech companies for pacemakers and tubing for cardiac surgery and every single one of the consumables we use to go into a no reuse policy. Which has become, in turn, a one of our marketing tools in order to become a center of excellence for the region and attract patients that will make our operation sustainable and make it possible for us to bring patients from other countries, children from other countries with congenital heart defects that need and deserve world-class medical care. Now, what and the kind of price differences that I'm talking about is we get a consumable, a bioprosthesis, a valve, a pig valve for the heart. We get it a seventh of the price that you get here.
How much?
A seventh.
1/7.
And a 12th of the price that it's sold for in Japan, for instance.
I would say that if you look at that, and a good chunk of it is, some part of it is the salary, some part of it is the materials, but the bulk of the cost is the organization. Okay. It is not, but you'd agree with that, it's the how you organize it. You get some savings, but you don't drive the cost down to what you've got because you organize the same way. You were organized very, very differently. And part of it is outreach. I think a simple way you described it is amortization of fixed costs. you have a very high patient flow. And also, when you analyze what is described in the NH model in Bangalore, it is a step-by-step procedure in Sachin. You might want to address that. You've actually looked at some of these numbers. How would you compare driving down the cost through salary, material, versus management and organization?
Okay, what I want to make a distinction of is that by saying lower salary, we're not just saying that India is a lower labor market and therefore we pay less. What they've actually done is taken the process, in Narayan Hrudayalaya's case, the process of a surgery. They've broken it down and they've picked out the pieces that can be done by a person with lower skill than a full-scale surgeon. That same economics applies in the United States as well. See, when we say we have a lower cost of procurement of inputs, it's not simply give it to us cheaper because we are a poor country. They've actually partnered locally to create suture packs at a third of the price. So it's new developed product. In the case of Arvind, the intraocular lens is, that's one of the big sales. They do it for $3 as opposed to close to 100 abroad. So we're not simply talking about a lower cost economy and therefore lower cost inputs and lower cost labor. We're talking about genuine innovations in the way we provide that process and the way we execute that process that allow us to do the achieve the same results with a lower level of resource utilization, be it manpower resource utilization, be it input cost resource utilization. And yes, the second element is each of these models works hard to drive through a high patient volume to create a much higher capital resource utilization. So I want to make that distinction.
What I would add, by the way, in other words, is that this model contains each of these elements, a real focus on getting each one more efficient than we see, for instance, here. And when we talk about the consumables and the drive by one of these types of examples to go out and manufacture their own sutures, their own ocular lenses or something like that, it actually then also brings revenue enhancement. They then package and sell these. And that is, again, something that's part of the model, which allows you then to have more social outreach, and you've brought the cost down, you're bringing your revenues up. It's a neat aspect, and maybe we can talk about it. I just want to allow some questions to come in, because there were some hands.
I have two questions. The first is a little bit from the first session, which is, and I'm not sure when the Heart Hospital was founded, but has there been a long enough time to know what the burnout is on the surgeons when they're working at such an increased flow than we're accustomed to? And a second question is, for the doctor referring to HIV/AIDS as a specialty, it seems quite different to me than a heart condition or an eye condition, in that it attacks so many different areas of the body, and I wonder how the approach that you're using in your specialty hospital for something like HIV/AIDS is different from what you employ in the heart hospital.
The first question related to the high throughput and the burnout situation, at least 20, 30 years of experience, we have been continuing with this, that we got used to that. So it's not a question of burnout with that. Second, when we're talking about, HIV, I given it as an example, but we are not doing it as a specialized entity. But we do treat the HIV patients, be it inpatient critical illness related to multi-organ dysfunction or as an outpatient retroviral treatment at a cost-effective price. So, but it's in the same whole context, not as a specialized entity. I think that these are the two things.
One issue that has not been mentioned at all, which I think may have a big influence, is that of regulation. In other words, how much of the model depends on regulation or lack thereof? In other words, I've been thinking every time that you mentioned something, if you were to use the same disposable twice here, you will be sued. My doctor tells me that a large proportion of his of my bill is malpractice insurance. In many of the hospitals, I believe in the United States, a lot of procedures can only be performed by registered nurses. They will not allow you to have high school students doing any of this stuff. You may not be allowed, even in Latin America, to buy certain medications or certain disposables. They have to be certified. I don't want to say FDA certified, but they have to be certified. So my question is, how much of this is dependent on the regulation or lack thereof? How much can you get away with because you can do certain things? In other words, we do know that regulation is a big deterrent to innovation. And maybe you can do a lot of this innovation because I'm asking this question because if we want to do this, I'm thinking already ahead of my Latin America, we may want to start looking at the issue of regulation and try to see how can we get around it. Second question very quickly is, what has been the position of the government vis-a-vis your models? In other words, do you get sabotage? Do you get support from them? Do you get indifference from them? Again, thinking ahead, I think if we were to be doing a little bit of these models, quite a few politicians will be jealous of it, and we may have to start looking for political opposition and try to overcome that political opposition from the get-go. In other words, capture them or bring them into some of these things.
The first thing in relation to the regulation, I fully agree that the regulation do increase or drive up the cost in the U.S. But the lack of regulation, as you rightly said, encourages us innovation. And at the same time, we are mentally prepared, though there is a lack of regulation in terms of regulation is to ensure the patient safety and the efficacy. And that is where the self-regulation comes into picture in our situation. In fact, the lack of regulation drives us to be self-regulated so that we are talking about a quality of international standards. That means despite lack of regulation, despite innovation in this type of technology development or its utilization, when we are looking at the outcomes, when we are looking at the outcomes in terms of whether you are following these regulations versus this outcome, when you are not having these regulations, you are comparing the outcomes. Suppose a simple example of reuse of materials. When we are reusing the materials, we are taking the process of re-sterilization through the same process which a factory does in terms of their sterility condition testing and everything. Only thing is we are optimizing that process of re-sterilization so that the outcomes reflect the international outcomes using non-re-sterilizable or non-reusable material. So I fully agree that as a developed world, you have to relook at your own regulations which are driving up the prices. A revisit of regulation in terms of material usage, in terms of malpractice thing, in terms of the
generics. But the other point you should mention is when you manufacture things, you do often manufacture to CMARC FDA specifications.
Yeah, but when we are manufacturing, let us say in India, there was no regulatory body for the devices because there was no manufacturing base. But as the manufacturing base has started, like we are now setting up our own stent manufacturing and catheter manufacturing. But we are following, though there are no regulations within the country, but being physicians, we understand what quality issues that we have to address when we get into this technology manufacturing.
I mean, on your first question of regulations, I think we should spend a whole new track for the U.S. specifically on our liability concerns, our regulation concerns, because they are, I'm not a physician, but from their experiences, they are exaggerated. Our liability fears have led us to procedures that are by definition inefficient, purely, and therefore account for a certain material portion of our cost. I'll come to you just on the second question. Maybe Juan can answer that. Oops, sorry.
Quick follow-up. Do you have then an auditing system inside your hospital
yes.
to ensure all of that?
Yes.
Independent
yes.
audit? Yeah, I don't mean accounting audit. I mean technical audit.
Yeah,
make sure that all of these.
We have a medical audit system that ensures that the outcomes are monitored on a regular basis.
Independent?
Yeah, independent.
But how far out are your outcomes actually followed, for instance, for brain surgery, corneal transplantation surgery? If you are reusing instruments, you know, you're not only talking about immediate infectious diseases, but you're talking about prion diseases, which may present years later. So how far out are you looking at that?
So we are not addressing the long-term unforeseen infections in that situation. I agree with that. agree with that, that the long-term unforeseen situation. But in terms of we looking at the prioritization, a population which requires the basic health care and which goes the highest blindness in the world on account of lack of basic health care is not looking at, so we need to prioritize. We need to prioritize as to what the population requires.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
That really isolates it from making it not translatable to American health.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let me say this. First thing we established is that the material cost reduction is not their primary cost reduction.
Yeah.
Therefore, this is not the major issue we should focus on. It is an issue, but I think we can get substantial savings if we retool how we manufacture, if we buy things from these guys rather than from our extremely high-priced guys here. You'd probably save 80 or 90% of material costs in a hospital. So, I think, and without reuse. So I don't think the reuse is...
Yes.
The reissue is,
yeah.
is an
in fact,
issue.
I mean, we are moving towards...
But the next
reuse.
Question is
the
one that...
You're
moving
not,
to single use.
Yeah.
The
it's not a major part at all.
Is what does government do? How do you is government your enemy or your friend or
you know,
how do you
Juan,
relate to government?
Juan can actually has some interesting experiences in Colombia.
What you're saying is absolutely. Where are you from? I'm sorry.
I'm from Spain, but I've been working in Latin America for 37.
He's with the Inter-American Development Bank. He's
I was
a guest here as an observer to see if. They can help set up more of these hospitals.
I
give you money.
I was going to ask. Oh, good. So let me. I thought you were Argentinian, perhaps, since you mentioned Latin America and Southern Latin America. So, but what we've been. I mean, Colombia, because of its closeness to the United States, has a number of regulations that are not realistic. For our reality, in terms of resterilization, there was no resterilization policy, for instance, and we have been the ones to effect that paradigm shift, and gradually move to a sustainable single use system, which I personally believe is the only way to go, I think. But as long as it's sustainable and affordable, because it's no use in having things that you can use or using everything only once if you can only cover 14% of the population. You need to strive for, you know, a 100% coverage. The government has done us good and bad. But for the most part, what we've done as an NGO, through private funding that has allowed us to invest in capital and technology, while we make our operations sustainable on a day-to-day basis. But one of the things that we're finally being able to implement is what we call hospital duty-free zones. We as a foundation are able to import supplies directly from our strategic partners without some of the duties, but as a hospital duty free zone, we're going to be able to import new technology, CAT scanners, MRIs, you know, the really expensive stuff, with no extra cost. In other words, we will be able to get it at the quote-unquote Latin American price, FOB, without the duties that we're otherwise having to pay these days. And that, we think, is going to make a major difference. Now, there are other battles and fronts we're fighting these days, and one of them is to try and fight the vertical integration of those health management organizations that are the ones managing the state's money that's supposed to go to the people, and the way we're trying to combat that is not through lobbying, since that failed and we never got involved in that, but through results and transparency. We believe that through a by running a totally transparent operation that has results benchmarked against the Society of Thoracic Surgeons in the States, in our particular case, or Cleveland Clinic Foundation, one of our strategic partners in the States, will be able to show those, you know, the government as well as the as industry and healthcare providers, that that good care is actually cost effective, and eventually educate patients to look and seek those centers of excellence, as opposed to be just, you know, guided like or herded like sheep to the cheaper, lower quality centers.
Let me give you a quick story out of India on the government front, just real quick.
Sure.
The eye care hospital that we've been speaking about, Arvind, it's got all these characteristics. It uses it uses lower skilled people for some processes, and the good thing about having a poor illiterate population is that they don't understand externally imposed regulations. They understand results at the end of it. So it becomes a vehicle for powerful political folks in a democratic system to provide their constituents with medical care that works. So Arvind, for example, has been invited to set up a hospital in Amethi, which is a constituency of the scion of India's most powerful family, Rahul Gandhi. So he's actually invited them to set up a hospital in the constituency that he gets elected from. So in a democratic system, you know, people don't understand. People are too, if they're too illiterate to understand regulations or what they imply to their lives, they'll go with quality of care. They can understand quality of care.
Do you have problems with government, or can government help you?
I think the government is slowly getting away from the delivery of healthcare in India, because it's going more and more towards the private healthcare delivery. But increasingly, it might be coming into the coverage of population, especially the below the poverty line. Like there are at least now 4 or 5 state governments which are adopting a policy of insuring, a compulsory insurance of people below poverty line. That means almost 90% of the villages will be insured by the governmental system. So because the government failed to be efficient in the delivery mechanism, they're getting out of delivery mechanism, which is going more into the private hands. Whereas coverage system, which the American system is supposed to be inefficient in terms of the administrative cost,
sure.
40% going into the administrative cost. Whereas if it is a regulated and a single point incident system, the administrative cost can be as low as 2%, as exemplified by the Canadian system. So the government the direction the government is evolving is getting into the coverage area, especially for the poor people.
But when you talk about government, you're talking about your state government, because the federal doesn't take the health burden. It's all devolved to the state,
health is
isn't
on
it?
The state. Yeah.
Correct.
So it's state by state.
Yeah, state by state.
Everybody
correct.
Knows.
Your question.
You talked about the fear of liability. For physicians in the United States, it's not a fear, it's a reality. In the state where I live, you cannot practice medicine unless you pay a malpractice premium that is not infrequently runs into tens of thousands of dollars and occasionally in six figures. So I have 3 questions. Do physicians in India, are they required to pay malpractice premiums? If so, what would be the average malpractice premium for a cardiologist? And if I were to take this myself of the excellent medical care there, what would be my legal recourse if I
run out?
Would be
we do have the malpractice, medical legal malpractice system, the protecting product system. But currently our premium are very, very less. At least the malpractice premium is, it comes to hardly about $300 per year.
And as a percentage of income?
As a percentage of income also is very small.
Yeah.
It's very, very small.
I can tell you what your legal recourse is, but
yeah.
What's your legal recourse?
No. I mean, the answer to your question is yes. They are required to have.
Yes,
to
I
have.
Yeah.
But the legal recourse, to answer your question openly and honestly, is very limited in your context. I'll tell you why in your context. Because if I can, I'll give a brutal
example, not a real, if I lost an arm because Dr. Rogers slipped in the heart surgery that I needed and went straight into my arm, and I lost it, the fact is that you have recourse in India. You have a legal system that is very sophisticated. It may be slow at times, but it is a sophisticated, transparent legal system. You have recourse. However, the value of your arm would be approximately $200 to $1,000. I'm not sure if that's the recourse you would like.
No, I am a physician, so what I'm saying is that you talk about implementing this model in the United States,
right.
I can see the entire law pack rise up.
Right.
And how will it happen here? I mean, that's a topic for real discussion. How this can happen here is not through social entrepreneurs. It's through entrepreneurs. I think. I mean, I wouldn't be running this panel or thinking about this if I didn't think it was ultimately applicable here. I think our primary goal is India, China, South America, North Africa. Areas where it's going to be really resistant to this kind of systematic management reorganization, manpower reorganization, dropping the price of consumables and medicines is the United States and Europe. They are going to be deeply, deeply resistant. For all sorts of reasons. How could it happen? It could happen if there are entrepreneurs who say, we will provide high-quality, low-cost services in specialized areas and then begin to expand it. We already see that in cataract surgery. There are people who are doing it in cataract surgery. But it is going to be a huge challenge. So I think John Michael and I have contented ourselves to say that if we can help half the world, we will be happy.
Enormous.
If that happens, we'll bring the United States and Europe to back.
I'm envious. I'm going to think it's wonderful that you can practice where your main focus is patient and not
But I should point out that, I mean, what you're seeing out here is the most, are people who practice medicine because it's a calling from God. So, and there are plenty in India who don't deserve the label of doctor. Let me assure you, a large proportion of the people who practice in India do not deserve to go near a patient.
Go
near a patient.
Right.
To go
I mean,
near
to put
a
this
patient.
Into context.
Well,
we
promised you a minute. Didn't we promise Bell a minute for telling her what's going to happen to the United States if we don't control
well,
it?
We have 10 minutes left, and I wanted to get to two things. I mean, the one thing I wanted to say is we are not coming up with a model that is the solution for the U.S. We're hoping that some elements of this might actually trigger some discussion here in the U.S., like, for instance, how do you reduce costs and all of these things. I don't know where you find the political will to find, you know, liability reform and all of that stuff. So I don't know. I actually have a question for you because I wanted to involve you in the discussion. So if you don't mind, I have a question about all this because our model is about social health care. And it requires an element of are we looking to put for-profit principles and apply them into a not-for-profit environment because we think there's some efficiencies that can be obtained in achieving sustainability, and yet, in my ideal world, we'd all have little Bill Gates models where we all find lots of terrific ways of making a lot of money that we then apply to social good. Within our economic model of a great medical system, that might actually be the case. There was a very famous, well-known person in this room just a little while ago called Vinod Khosla, one of the premier venture capitalists in the world. And he instantly had an interesting point. He said, you know, you need to really keep your focus. If you're a business, you need to keep it on the business focus. If you're a charity, you need to keep charity focus. You cannot mix the two. That's kind of disappointing to me because we're actually trying to mix the two. But he boiled it down in 10 seconds that you really need to remain focused. So my question is, Can you mix the two? You're a not-for-profit person. Does it require a different philosophy? Does it require a different gene?
I absolutely agree that you can mix the two, and that's what we've been doing for 17 years. And I wanted to give you two examples. One is in Africa, in Rwanda, where we work at the bottom of the pyramid, completely with the communities, hand in hand with their suggestions, our suggestions. It's really born out of a real, real partnership. And what we do is we do a business because we invest. We don't loan. We don't do all that stuff. We invest in people. So we have what we call our FXB village model, which is 80 families, and that is 500 people, most of whom are children. Each head of family is given the worth of $100 of an income-generating activity. And we also invest that first year in their health care, meaning we pay what we call their health insurance. Now, with their income-generating activity, because this is, it's very comprehensive. It's cost-effective, it's sustainable, it's empowering the people, the beneficiaries, those families, and also the wider community. And it's really implementing the link between health and human rights in the field. So we follow what we call the KABP continuum, which is giving them knowledge, giving them care, giving them the I'm so jet-lagged that I have to read my stuff, and or changing their attitudes, which also changes their behaviors, and also giving them processes of how to take care of themselves. Now, this cost of this health insurance, as I said, is $100 the first year. We take care of that village for 3 years. And over those 3 years, they, the second year, pay already, because they're making money with their invest, their own income-generating activity, they pay 25% of, we only pay 25% of their insurance cost. They then, in turn, on the, they contribute, 25% they contribute the second year. 50% they contribute the third year, and when we leave them on their own, they're completely economically sustainable. They send their children to school, they pay the school fees, they get their food, they can repair their houses, and they pay 100% of their health insurance. In the meantime, over the second year, usually what they do is they also group together and they have an income-generating activity of the group, which sometimes we fund, and sometimes they even fund themselves because they've made savings. And within that group, they continue, and they've revived an African tradition that I don't know if you have in Nigeria called the tontine, which is like a savings bank. And each family contributes to this savings bank with this new income-generating activity, which then takes care of extra health expenses or funerals or a roof that's gone with a tornado or God knows what. And these people have been saved. We have 44,000 people in 11 years in Rwanda. 85% of them have become self-sustainable and take care of their health costs. Of course, this doesn't include ARVs, so now what we're doing is we're linking them up. Thank goodness we are near Kigali. We're an hour and a half away from Kigali in that community. So we're linking them up with the hospital, and we're getting them the access to the ARVs. So this has changed completely the life of all these people. And what else can I tell you? I mean, they are totally self-sustainable. And in Colombia, we've done something else. In Colombia, where we work in Barranquilla, which is a very backwater place, which you know, with a big AIDS epidemic, what we've done there is we have a community house where we take care of the community and the families, not at all in the same FXB village model. It's a community place. But what we've done to help with the health care is that we've made what we call FXB drug stores. We establish commercial agreements with the ARV producers. We've done this way back. We started 10 years ago when Colombia wasn't giving out officially the ARVs, because there's still blockages that we have to overcome. But when we started, we made the agreements with the ARV producers, either the medicines or the generics, and with the retailers of the brand, and we purchase in bulk, and we do speed payments. So by purchasing bulks of general medicines and ARVs, and by speeding the payment, we get a very low price already, and we get a discount of 5% because we pay quickly. So with the money that we've saved there, what we do is we sell it back to the health insurers, and the non-insured individuals who have high income, who therefore have a sustainability to continue to buy the ARVs. And what we're doing, we're also doing a lot of advocacy and legal battles, and we're even suing the government and the private institutions like the Bienestar Familial. Mm-hmm. so that we do get access for these patients. So we do a number of other little things in Brazil, and we also work with, but it's not specifically into healthcare of systems of healthcare. We work with the migrants because of the wars. We take care of a lot of people there. That's also with help of the Global Fund. But I'd like to mention, because we don't have much time, so I don't want to elaborate too much. If you're interested in what we do, you can go to our site, which is fxb.org. You'll see all the programs. But I came across a very efficient hospital process, if I may mention it, in Brazil, that a remarkable woman who's Dr. Vera Cordeiro does. She has a hospital for children in Sao Paulo. And what she does is that when the children come for disease or whatever, to be cured or even an operation, then she and the nurses go back into the favela and they follow up with the families, the caretaking, because they were seeing kids coming back over and over and over again just because they were not given the right nutrition or sanitation or very easy little medicines to keep them going. And that has reduced the number of consultations in the hospital, and therefore it's reduced also the cost of the healthcare. I thought it was a remarkable procedure that could be extended to other hospitals and also for others. I haven't taken up too much time. If anybody has questions,
Thank you very much. I would gladly stay for questions. We have about a minute left. I just wanted to highlight where I think we are as a snapshot.
So it's a business. What I want to say is a business, and it's not, and it's charity, but I don't like charity. It's self-sustainable development, but it is business because we invest, but we reap the returns in the benefits of the society itself and the sustainability.
Well, and I think that that's an important point, because as we use the term sustainability, I think we, you know, I'm a business person. I tend to look at things on spreadsheets, and they make sense. But the thing that you cannot put into that mix, and which we should, is the social return. How do you measure the return of an improved health society, of the mental health, of the happiness, of the welfare you're bringing to these families? I think in our sustainability calculations, we should certainly add some measure of our effectiveness, both in terms of that.
And there's just one that I'd like to add for Africa, is that by doing what we're doing in that sustainability and raising a generation of AIDS orphans who otherwise would drift into drugs, prostitution, child soldiers, whatever, we're also preventing extra costs downstream to heal those illnesses of society that we're preventing upstream by these tiny little investments.
So I mean, our conclusion is really that, as again we've added some learning today, is that we will pursue models and we will support them that are really centers of excellence, that have a holistic approach in bringing together certain specializations, but they're also holistic in the sense of that they look at preventative and, in your examples, post-care treatment. Scale, it will be a part of our model, because that's where some of these efficiencies are derived from. And we will look for other cost-centric efficiencies in terms of bringing maybe man utilization costs down or consumable costs down, as well as some revenue enhancements. Our key focus will remain on attacking and supporting systems that are really talent-driven, because in order to maintain world-class, you still need to, in each region, be able to attract the best talent possible to maintain that. And lastly, our goal will always be to have social reach and social care within the context of wherever the local system is. I want to conclude and just thank everybody. I want to thank Bill. I want to thank Albina. I want to thank Juan, Sachin, and Dr. Reddy, and Dr. Soma Roger, all for coming and helping. I want to thank Blaise Gomez, who sits behind me, who's been working with us in India and New York for a couple months, and we owe to him many of the pieces that actually make us look relatively organized. And thank you to Michelle and her colleagues at the Aspen Institute. If there are any more questions, we're here and we're happy to entertain as many questions. Oh yeah, and in conclusion, if you'd like to say what your impression is and how it maybe applies to your program.
I'm happy to, but I don't want to keep people. I'm an economist, and I have focused on the health of the fiscal situation in the United States. And as probably most of you know, we have very large budget deficits, and they are projected to go far, far larger driven out this inexorable increase in healthcare spending per capita. So that sets the stage for what Bill said earlier, which is that we are desperately in need of more innovative ways of thinking about how to organize healthcare in the United States and how to get the costs under control without diluting the quality of what we do.
And we're going to have huge, as you pointed out, huge social impediments. Let me just say a bottom line for a social impediment. I was describing this to Tremonti, who was at that time deputy prime minister of Italy and the former economic minister. And he said, well, it is very reasonable to think about how to rationalize healthcare costs. We have the problems you have. Let me show you a countervailing point. In our society, the only guaranteed job growth we can foresee is in healthcare services.
That is a countervailing point.
And it is a major problem here as well. And so I see this as a race for a catastrophic collapse of healthcare services, which will happen, or a rationalization of healthcare delivery. I'm hoping at least through this Ideas Festival to introduce an idea that there is a way to dramatically lower healthcare costs, but in radical institutional surgery in the United States. In India and China, it's a creation of new institutions. Here, it's a which is a heck of a lot harder.
You have to do away with a bunch of lawyers.
Yes, that's what Juan said.
I'll carry a message back for me. The Aspen Institute is interested in pursuing this. Apparently, the Brookings Institution was not.
Oh, I don't think that's true, Bill, but we'll have a lot of conversation.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.